The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
Well, good morning. Let's get underway here. If you all can hear me. My name is Chris Schlecht. I'm at New St. Andrews College. We actually have our booth right across the way out those doors here, even an alumna here in the audience, so people actually come back for more of this punishment. It's a curiosity to me that I'm standing here delivering this lecture. This is really my idea of a good time, why the conference organizers let me do this. You'll have to talk with them, but I enjoy this stuff. I think that what they're after is a sort of demonstration of academic creativity at work. Tomorrow, I'm going to be presenting on history skills, and maybe that could be sort of the Oz behind the curtain of what you see here. But let's talk about print culture and Protestant culture in the early 20th century. I want to begin with this article from the Milwaukee Sentinel from June of 1930. And it records that a Presbyterian church just outside Milwaukee ordained a woman named Sarah E. Dixon to the office of ruling elder. And the article reports that this moment was history being made. Dixon was the first woman to be regularly ordained to the ruling eldership in the entire history of American Presbyterianism. Now, that's a history that stretches back to 1706. Now, just a few days before her ordination, the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church amended its book of order to allow this to happen, so Milwaukee's Sarah Dixon became a first in history. Over the next year, a handful of other women across the country became ruling elders in their churches, and the next year's General Assembly, 1931, seated five women as voting delegates. How did this come about back in the 1930s? In the period between the two world wars, in the 20s and 30s, Presbyterians and Methodists and Episcopalians and Baptists and Congregationalists all wrestled with the question of women's ordination. Why? What was going on? Well, the answer has to do, as I'll get to in a while, the answer has to do with church bulletins, which is why the lecture gave the title that it has. There's a lot more to the story than church bulletins, though. The larger story of women's ordination has less to do with the shift in theology as with the shift in the everyday routines of Protestant religious practice, and that's what I want to talk about. Many have said that our actions flow out of our theology, but let's not forget that our theology often flows out of our actions. The course of history is driven by big ideas, but not just big ideas. History is also about everyday habits and routines and life ways and experiences of ordinary people. So why should we care about the story of women's ordination in the interwar period? Because it's a story about a change in gendered sensibilities. A shift in cultural conventions surrounding manhood and womanhood that took place in the interwar period. And I think it can shed light for us today, since we face dizzying cultural changes surrounding similar issues related to the identity of men and women. Last year, we witnessed the first woman to complete ranger training in the United States Army without any adjustments having been made to the standards. Last season, the National Football League hired two women as officials. And the Phoenix Cardinals hired a woman into its coaching staff to coach linebackers, of all things. In December, Defense Secretary Ash Carter announced that there's no role in any branch of the United States military service that women may not fill. All restrictions based on sex have been removed. And, of course, we're familiar with the Obergefell decision that was handed down last year that declared that same-sex couples have a constitutional right to marry. I'm not suggesting that we can draw a straight line of causation from the interwar period to today, as if today's developments are a direct consequence of women's ordination. Today's developments actually resulted from a whole lot more than that, a cocktail of a whole lot more factors than that. I want to take us back to the 1920s and 30s, not so much as a quest for an origin story for how we got to today, but rather to look at another historical instance when a major gendered shift occurred. We have the benefit of hindsight when we look back at the interwar period, and we gain clarity that comes from observing cultural change sort of from a distance, a kind of clarity that's unavailable to us when we examine the cultural changes that we're experiencing right now. The fact that the 1920s and 30s was a different era than our own is worth our attention. One of the best ways, I think, to understand the peculiarities of our own culture is to travel to a different culture and look back. And this is precisely the kind of benefit that history offers. The story of women's ordination in the interwar period and the cultural context that produced it is helpful to us because it's a story of gendered change. And it can help us better understand how these things come about. It's also important because it reminds us about the way history works. The story of women's ordination, as I said a moment ago, is not a story about the influence of big theological change. And so it reminds us that there are plenty of other motivating factors behind human action besides the theological reflection that humans undertake. You don't get to know a person fully by simply getting to know their theology, by getting them to recite their creed. How much more true is this when historians try to get to know an entire time period? We need to think about this when we think about our big fat books in the history of ideas. Unfortunately, I've seen many church historians limit their gaze to theological ideas when they study the past. In doing so, they often overlook some of the most crucial developments that shape the Christian church. History is much broader than the history of big ideas that people think. Church history is much broader than the history of the theological ideas that church people think. Now, I'm going to be the last one to criticize the study of historical theology. I think that that kind of study is important, and I undertake it all the time in my teaching. My complaint is with the tendency on the part of some to rush to the history of ideas as the only key, as if that's the only key to unlock the doors of the past. Now, historians of American religion do describe the 20s and 30s as a decade of theological controversy, and indeed it was. We have creation evolution, Scopes trial, fundamentalism and modernism. But Protestants also wrestled with issues that aren't reducible to bare theological ideas. Protestants were wrestling probably more with bobbed hair and dancing and lipstick and movies and prohibition and jazz and poverty and children in the workplace and divorce. When it comes to the issue of women's ordination, most historians have tried to account for the change in women's status in the church by examining the theological discourse about women. But the theological arguments for women's ordination that prevailed in the 1920s are the same old arguments that by that time had been around for a couple generations. In fact, the most widely referenced book in the ordination debates of the 1920s was a book that had been published way back in 1889 and had not fallen out of circulation. The arguments for women's ordination hadn't changed at all. Well, if the theology of women did not change, something changed. What did change? And this is the question that I aim to answer. And once again, we're going to find the answer by examining everyday routines, material objects, even architectural space, all of which reveals an administrative revolution that transformed American Protestantism in the early decades of the 20th century. I argue that this administrative revolution came freighted with gendered significance, and it fueled change in women's status in the churches. It's a story of gendered change that can help us understand our own times. So, here's the bottom line here, rushing to the end, the punchline. I argue that the rise of women's ordination had to do less with changes in theology, which is what historians usually point to, and it had more to do with an administrative transformation that swept across American Protestantism in the early 20th century. And I'm going to approach this by, first of all, describing this administrative transformation. This is going to bring us back to church bulletins and print culture. I will get there. And then we'll talk about the gendered implications of it. All of this, again, I offer up to you as an example of a historian being playful with and creative with the past. That's what I'm trying to do. This is what the conference organizers wanted me to do. So here, watch me have my fun. All right. The turn of the 20th century, Protestants across the United States placed administration at the center of their religious practice. They consolidated their missionary and educational and benevolence organizations. They integrated local, regional, and national expressions of church life. They extolled organizational efficiency as a cardinal virtue of a unique renewal movement. Now, over the centuries, Christians have met Jesus in various ways. Some Christians have met Jesus in prayer. Others encountered him in the waters of baptism or at the communion table. Still others have found Jesus in seclusion, in miracles, in fasting or other deprivations, in performing selfless acts of charity, in music, in soul-stirring sermons. But here, in the early 20th century, American Protestants met Jesus by organizing. They partook of divine grace in activities that could be diagrammed on flowcharts, tallied in ledgers, organized into filing cabinets, printed in bulletins, and moved, second, adopted, and recorded in minutes. Now, I don't have time to consider all the facets of this transformation, but I want to hit on a cluster of them: architecture, record-keeping practices, habits of giving, and then we'll get back to church bulletins and finally women's ordination. And I want to begin with architecture. Ecclesiastical architecture, which may be the most symbolic of this transformation that I'm describing to you. Specifically, a very important feature that enters ecclesiastical architecture, church office spaces. So I give you Art Street Presbyterian Church that was built in 1913. It's in Philadelphia, downtown Philly in the center city. It's a beautiful building. Because I'm a nerd, I also go into the archives and find the blueprints for this building. And circled in red, if you, I don't know if you see it on the right there, is this space called office. Office. This was kind of a new thing around the turn of the century in ecclesiastical architectural space. Idlewild Presbyterian Church, beautiful building erected in Memphis, Tennessee in 1928. This is what the nave looks like. Beautiful building. And right here, the nerve center in 1928 are office spaces. Office spaces. A lot of things took place in this office space, and I want to talk about that in a moment. But if I could generalize from a trade magazine in architecture, the American Architect in 1925 has an extensive article on ecclesiastical architecture. And this is a floor plan that it puts forward as a typical large church. And circled in red, that all-important office. The church office. Now, what's interesting is if you take the same trade magazine, go back 25 years, another article from 1900, no office for a typical large church design. Offices, church offices are new in church buildings after the turn of the 20th century. I think an important development in ecclesiastical architecture. What did they do in church offices? What happened? Well, a number of things. The demands of congregational life became what one observer at the time was describing as a seven-day task. It was no longer the case that churches were busy only on Sundays. They had youth programs, women's societies, prayer meetings, a daily buzz of congregational activity that required coordination and staffing to manage. Sunday schools increased in enrollments and in sophistication, and they required specialists to manage them. They tracked enrollments and attendance and progress toward the next grade levels. Curricular norms in Sunday school became standardized across the nation. They were often tied to denominational publishing houses that produced graded Sunday school materials. And they increasing more and more, the denominations supplied training and standards for local churches to comply with. In addition to, here we see membership statistics and a number of things. This is explaining church administration here. In addition to Sunday school standardization, another force driving the systematization of religious activity was a rise in standardized record keeping. It's interesting, and this is one of the things I do when I go into archives. I actually look at church minutes. And one of the things that you see as you move from the late 19th century into the early 20th century is that local churches, in the minutes and the records they keep, lose their local idiosyncrasies in terms of format and form and style and content, and they look like other churches. And that's because of the promulgation of standards and norms for record-keeping practices. Local idiosyncrasies for record-keeping get lost, and denominations begin promulgating these norms. And what I have here in 1920, this is the Presbyterian General Assembly. This is the form of a report. This is how a presbytery should keep its statistics and submit its report to the General Assembly here. You have to follow this template, which means you have to keep certain kinds of records in certain styles. One of the most interesting administrative developments was the pledge system. Pledging requires individual donors to declare how much money they will give in the future. Denominational officials imposed this practice after managers of church agencies started preparing budgets. And of course, budgets have to do with predicting how much you will spend in the future. Budgeting requires projecting into the future. Prior to the 20th century, boards and agencies, publishing agencies, missionary agencies, whatever they might be, basically took in offerings that were collected from local churches and then sent into agency headquarters, and whatever was sent in is what they had to spend. Well, keeping my gaze on the Presbyterian story, I could tell the same thing about Baptist congregational associations and Lutherans and others. But in 1912, the Presbyterian General Assembly determined to replace this common practice with the pledge system so it could predict the level of support for denominational boards and agencies over the coming year so they could create a budget. But this means that you need to go out to individual parishioners and have them announce how much they will give over the next year. This system required local churches to restructure the way they collected funds, and more importantly, it called upon individual parishioners to alter their method and practice of giving. And to facilitate the collection of pledges, denominational publishers printed and distributed pledge cards for distribution to individual church members. Denominational managers trained teams in every church to call on parishioners and present them with a card to fill out. Parishioners would record on the card specific amounts they were supposed to give for the year. They designated pledges both to local churches and to the local church support and then to denominational causes on these ledgers. They called this double budget subscription, denominational causes and local church support. To make it easier to collect these subscriptions, denominations furnished printed envelopes for the use in local churches. Maybe some of you grew up with these, where you would make your pledge and then you would get a series of 52 envelopes predated to make sure that you would get your pledge in throughout the year, numbered and dated for each week of the year. Money, the best ones were two pocket envelopes, double pocket envelopes, where you'd put cash in for the local church and then cash in for the denominational agencies. To ensure uniform recording of pledges and collections, the denomination supplied record sheets for treasurers in every church. This whole system routinized Christian charity. by linking denominational headquarters to every individual church member and his pocket through a system of regional administrators intermediating. In the words of the Presbyterian General Assembly, the new budgeting system brings the individual subscriber into close touch with his own church and with the great worldwide enterprises undertaken by the Presbyterian Church as a whole. It results in giving a business system to our financial methods. Presbyterians heralded this type of vertical integration and coordination as a sacred achievement for the kingdom of God. Presbyterian General Assembly announced that this coordinated system of church organization magnifies weekly giving as an act of worship. Well, actually, this slide is advertising, primarily appealing to Baptists, because Baptist denominations didn't print the envelopes. So entrepreneur printers printed envelopes so that Baptist churches could buy them. And so you have advertisements for collection envelopes. But I want to come back to church architecture. This brings us to a new type of church architecture that emerges in the ecclesiastical landscape of the United States. Now, if you study medieval cathedrals, I think you should, and study the architecture and the Parthenon, things like that. Well, I study early 20th century ecclesiastical architecture, so I'm stuck with this stuff. Denominational headquarters buildings begin popping up in the ecclesiastical landscape and deserves our attention, just like medieval cathedrals do. And what does this say about the lifeways and religious practices of Christians? So this is the Methodist Book Concern, Fifth Avenue, New York. In fact, Fifth Avenue, a certain sector of Fifth Avenue in New York, became known as America's Paternoster Row for all of the headquarters buildings. This is the building today, historic picture in picture today. The Presbyterian building, built in 1895, it's still there today. It's no longer owned by the Presbyterian Church, but for a long time it was the home for the Presbyterian Board of Foreign Missions. Contemporary picture, and as I understand, Sarah Jessica Parker has a shoe shop at the ground retail level of that building today. Congregational House for the Congregationalists. Here's a historic picture in Boston. This is a wonderful building. Those friezes out front are really quite fascinating, and I could offer a study of those, but time doesn't allow me to do so. And if you were an observer of the show Ally McBeal, this was the site of the outside shots for the Cajun Fish law firm that she worked in. But it was a denominational headquarters for Congregational Association. My favorite building, and I'm always looking at the Presbyterian stuff, back to Philadelphia, the Witherspoon Building. This is a fantastic building. You need to go to Philadelphia. I've spent hours photographing this building. It's now owned by a bank, but it's got, I could just go on and on with all of these coins and friezes here all around it. If you're a Presbyterian guy, this is the luminaries of Presbyterian history all around the building here. Also in Philadelphia, the Schaff Building, the German Reformed Church, that's a historic picture. That's what it looks like today. What this points to is these offices that I was describing earlier in local churches. Well, they're connected to headquarters buildings. Administrative infrastructure is on the rise in American Protestantism, and architecture tells that story. Architecture, building fabric tells that story. But I want to come around finally to print culture. This brings us to newsletters and bulletins, one of the most important functions that was taking place in church office spaces. In the early 20th century, Protestants across the United States began turning out form letters, bulletins, calendars, and newsletters. All of this locally generated printed material allowed parishioners to keep abreast of needs to meet, causes to support, events to take part in throughout the week. Their publications announced exciting events coming up. They help members stay abreast of progress in fundraising, outreach work, and other projects. Seniors could learn what the youth in the church were up to, and parents could take pride in seeing their little Johnny's name in print in the church newsletter. Protestants use locally printed material to rally parishioners to action and to solidify their ties to the church community and even draw new prospective members into the buzz and camaraderie of congregational life. By the 1920s, most American Protestants received a printed bulletin when they entered a house of worship on Sunday mornings. But this development was new. It was as new to their religious routine as arriving to worship by automobile. The faithful enlisted small-time Hearsts and Pulitzers as religious workers who inked and turned the drums of their tabletop duplicating machines and forged a new print culture that reshaped the American Protestant way of religious being and belonging. Historians have long observed how, in the early 20th century, mass printing aimed at the everyman helped construct a national consumer identity. Historians of print talk about this, with new financing mechanisms and transportation network that allowed publishers and advertisers and writers to put down their values in print and to put them on coffee tables all across the American landscape. Well, I found a similar process at work in local church contexts just a couple decades later with the advent of church newsletters and bulletins. This is perhaps the most significant aspect of the broader administrative transformation I've been describing. And so my research traces what became of this localized print culture and the administrative culture that it signified, and it boils down to a couple of consequences. The first consequence is a shift away from the formation of our religious identity around personal bonds and toward a less personal, mediated notion of religious solidarity. In previous eras, before this transformation, I keep on saying transportation, the Protestant faithful had defined sacred community around face-to-face Sunday gatherings by hearing sermons, singing hymns together, praying together, and other ritual acts together. Now, Protestants began shaping congregational identity by printing paper, disseminating it, and reading it. That was a huge consequence. And second, printing, along with other forms of administration, opened new opportunities for women in Protestant church life. I promised that I would, at the outset, that I would get to women's ordination. That's still coming. All right, so I want to begin now by taking a careful study of what happened with this print culture. Those are the two implications here. But I want to take you to A.B. Dick, Albert B. Dick of Chicago, who gave the mimeograph its name in 1887. That was the year he secured licensing rights from the guy who invented it, who was Thomas Edison. The mimeograph fit easily on a desktop or table, and it required little training to operate. It produced a printed page by mechanically pressing an ink-filled pad over a stencil, which left an image on the paper. The stenciled image reproduced by mimeograph couldn't match the sharpness of printing or typewriting, and oftentimes the stencils were made by typewriter with a certain kind of waxed paper. Usually these stencils would deteriorate over the course of a print run. Nonetheless, the mimeograph made small run duplication feasible, and they proved useful to many businesses and especially to churches. The mimeograph competed in popularity for another machine called the multigraph, pictured here. It was manufactured by a Cleveland-based American multigraph company that had formed in 1902 and had obtained a patent the following year. Like the mimeograph, the multigraph could rest on an office table. It was easy to operate, but it featured a round drum faced with slots. And in these slots, you could actually put movable type. So what that object on the right, then, is actually the typesetting device that you would use to put the type onto the drum. By the second decade of the 20th century, by the 19-teens, the American multigraph company produced a separate typesetter, and that's what's pictured here. So once you'd have the drum set with type, an operator would turn it by hand or a little bit later by plugging it into electricity. And the turning drum pressed the type through a huge ink-filled ribbon and onto paper, creating a printed page. Because the multigraph printed with type rather than a stencil like the mimeograph did, it actually produced higher quality lettering than the mimeograph. The multigraph was also capable of larger print runs than the mimeograph because it didn't use fragile stencils that deteriorated over the course of the print run. American Multigraph became one of Cleveland's most important businesses. The building still stands today. I'm always looking at this business architecture. And LeBron is there in Cleveland, too. He's almost as important as the American Multigraph Company. So to save labor, another device to talk about, to save the labor of typing individual addresses. So we created these print runs of newsletters and such. But what if you want to do a mailing? Well, the addressograph steps in for this. This is also a tabletop contraption. The addressograph has a hopper that operators would load with a stack of metal plates, kind of like army dog tags. They're embossed metal plates, each of which had a unique address embossed onto it. And one by one, these plates would advance, and then you could put a unique address on top of a stack of papers. Backwards here. On the right is a graphotype, which actually made these embossed plates. Not too many offices had those. Oftentimes you'd farm out the creation of the embossed plates. But then you'd have your entire church directory in kind of a Rolodex of these embossed plates, and you'd suited to put into the addressograph, and then you'd go, whenever someone had an address change, you had to have a new plate made for them with the graphotype. Now, in 1931, engineers figured out how to unite these two machines, and the corporations actually combined to make the Addressograph Multigraph Company. So over on the right, you see a contraption that combines the operation of the addressograph and a multigraph so that you could turn out your multiple copies, and then each one would have an individual address printed on it. This is cool stuff. Well, the sales affiliate of this company had branch offices in cities across the country. It was one of the most conspicuous advertisers in business magazines. And I've got some ads here for the multigraph, for example, that appeared in 1922. And if you can see on the lower left, it's what it's describing is uses or who uses this multigraph here. And later in 1922, we see another list of multigraph users, and churches appear as among the prominent users of the multigraph that they're marketing to. This is a pretty typical ad that showed up in a magazine called Church Management, the pastor with his rolled up sleeves operating his multigraph. And the addressograph ad, Brooklyn Central Presbyterian Church, claims that the machine is one of the best time savers we have. Now, this is an interesting advertisement. This is an advertisement for an engraver who is selling cuts designed for church bulletins. What you could do is you could take these engravings, and they were designed to be fixed onto a multigraph drum. So you can actually get images onto your church newsletters. This advertisement reveals that duplicating machines had become so ubiquitous in church use as to produce an aftermarket, where new entrepreneurs could develop products and sell them on the assumption that churches already owned a multigraph. So the mimeograph, multigraph, and addressograph allowed Protestants to turn their local churches into small publishing and mailing houses. Before the advent of this machinery, only a handful of large urban churches could publish their own bulletins and newsletters. They had financial resources and easy access to professional printers. But these new machines proliferated, and many smaller, less affluent churches became little publishing houses. there's nothing more ubiquitous about the church-going experience than getting handed a bulletin on Sunday morning. We need to realize, historicize this, and understand what it means and what it represents. What became of it? One church publicity expert urged Protestants to embrace these new contraptions. When church members see their own religious activities described in print, he explained that church members solidify their own connection to the church. In his words, he said, "It puts folks on their mettle when they recognize that people will be watching them as a member of the church," in print. He went on to say that when parishioners read about what other church members are up to, they realize that they are not wholly alone in the community. Parishioners began identifying with one another through their shared experience of reading about local church life. They participated vicariously in church activities that they had not attended or participated in personally. They participated vicariously by reading about them. Another church management expert summed it up well when he praised church bulletins because it was excellent for cementing the thought of the people to the church. For all of its purported benefits, small-scale printing entered church life at a cost. Any community formed around print surrenders a measure of personal interaction. An obvious advantage of print that it has over real-time, face-to-face human contact is print's capacity to reach more people and with greater regularity. Writing can stretch across distances and outlive the life of an individual. But writing can do these things only because writing is, to a degree, an impersonal medium. It overcomes the limitations of a human body. Socrates made this observation, that writing separates human bodies from one another and inserts paper and ink in between them. Writers can write without having any personal contact with readers, and readers are reduced to an undifferentiated class, stripped of their individual qualities. Now, the implication for church life can be seen through the first introduction of printed more form letters into mainstream pastoral practice. The multigraph turned out the most effective form letters, unlike copies generated by mimeograph, and I commented on this a moment ago. Readers couldn't tell any difference between a multigraphed copy and a unique, personalized, typewritten original. And so multigraph users learned to leave a blank space on each copy where the addressee's name and address could be individually typed, or better yet, printed using the addressograph. This ability to add personal names and addresses to a multigraphed copy transformed the way pastors communicated with parishioners. Conventions of letter writing, dating back to the Middle Ages, long before Gutenberg invented movable type, had long solidified the form and structure of the personal letter. But those who wrote form letters learned to imitate these familiar conventions, and they appeared just like personal letters. Form letters delivered a uniform, duplicated message to a large number of undifferentiated recipients all at once. In short, multigraphs made it possible for pastors to send out impersonal messages posing as personal ones. An article in Church Management, this one pictured here, coached pastors on how to compose what he described as form letters to unseen groups, and the phrase is revealing. Form letters to unseen groups. This indicates a shift from personal to impersonal in pastoral care. Overwhelming reader response to this initial article that showed up in Church Management magazine convinced the magazine's editor to publish a regular advice column on how to write form letters for pastors. And the column appeared in every monthly issue for about a year. Advice about writing form letters became a regular topic in practical church manuals and became popular in the 10s and 20s, and also in denominational magazines of the period. One Presbyterian pastor, Ralph B. Gilbert, devoted an entire chapter on form letters in his 1925 instructional manual called The Church and Printer's Ink. And according to this author, the key to a successful form letter was to hide the impersonal nature of what is, in effect, a mass message. and to make it appear personal. This is the only way for a pastor to bridge the rhetorical distance that form letters introduce between himself and his parishioners. A Methodist minister prescribes specific strategies for, in his words, disguising the fact that it's a form letter. See, pastors weren't used to form letters yet, and pastors needed advice on how to write them. This Methodist advice columnist said that form letters must be copied using typefaces that imitate those in typewriters, because typewriters were associated with individualized personal communication. He counseled pastors to create form letters with a multigraph rather than a mimeograph. And he advised them to sign by hand each copy of the form letter. But if it was a large print run, he said, get an engraver to make a cut of your exact signature, which could then be attached to the multigraph drum and duplicated along with the text. He promised that, and this is his words, it looks enough like a real signature to give the psychological effect of a signature. Now, we're used to all of this today, but I invite you back into the mindset and the life ways and the change that its inception represented. All this effort that went into camouflaging the impersonal nature of form letters indicates that most Protestants still valued personal face-to-face interaction. Otherwise, why camouflage the fact that it's impersonal? Form letters came up short of this ideal, and so pastors had to develop strategies to try to compensate. Well, the impersonal nature of print culture is just one facet I've told you I've described as a wider administrative transformation that hit American Protestantism. Administration emerged as specialized work around the turn of the 20th century, as I've been saying, and this fellow, Frederick Winslow Taylor, was a pioneer and leading proponent of the theory of scientific management. Taylor studied workflows with an aim to maximize efficiency in the expenditure of time and money and human labor. He was concentrating his efforts on the manufacturing and production process. But the influence of Taylor and others launched management as a field all its own. In 1908, Harvard Business School offered for the first time its master's in business administration, consulting with Taylor. Managerial pioneers inspired new thinking in arenas other than manufacturing. Morris Cook adapted scientific management principles to the field of education. I could go on list application after application. A woman named Christine Frederick applied scientific management principles to the home in house whiffery, thus pioneering the field of home economics that emerged at this time. And for our purposes, the office and office routines were subjected to the scrutiny of scientific managers, and W.H. Leffingwell, portrayed on the left here, was a pioneer in those applications. And Protestants, of course, applied them to their religious practice. Chaloner Matthews was one of the most prominent Baptist leaders and ecumenical organizers of the day, and his work on the right, Scientific Management in Churches, which came out in 1912, specifically referenced Frederick Winslow Taylor and urged church members and churches to adopt scientific management principles in their church structures in Protestant church life. Many practical handbooks also appeared during this time to feed the growing hunger for advice in church administration. Look at the fun things you get to read when you go into the archives that I study. McGarrah's Works, Modern Church Program, Modern Church Finance, Practical Interchurch Methods, Modern Church Management, How to Make the Church Go, Church Publicity, Church Finance, Church Administration, on and on and on. This is fun reading, too, by the way. This is the stuff that I get into. And I'm just weird that way. Accountants, managers, and efficiency experts really emerged as important figures in American Protestantism after the turn of the century. The Presbytery of Chicago became convinced that pastors needed executive assistants to help them lead their churches. And so, and you see this on the right-hand image here, they launched the Presbyterian Training School. And this institution drew students by pointing out that efficiency is one of the slogans of the times. This Presbyterian Training School met a demand for church personnel who could help Protestants adapt new fiscal and organizational methods to their religious practice. Charles Spells on the left also was a church efficiency consultant. You see an advertisement for his services as well. All right. Now, let's get back to my initial question about women's ordination. In their quest to maximize efficiency, Protestants confronted the question of what place to give women in this newly ordered religious life that they were forging for themselves. The push for efficiency introduced ambiguity about the relationship between administration and spirituality, an ambiguity that hadn't existed before. But now, administration is so important. What's its relationship to spirituality? Frederick Winslow Taylor, the great industrial scientific manager pioneer, had taught that because humans are the chief sources of mistakes and inefficiencies, the key to efficiency lies in the removal of human idiosyncrasies from the productive process. Taylor termed older approaches to productivity personal management and set his own scientific approach over against the personal. And I think his own language is revealing here. Scientific management is a change from what, and he described the previous way as personal management, personal versus scientific management. Taylor wrote, this is a quote from Taylor, "In the past, the man has been first. In the future, the system must be first." Taylor envisioned administrators as objective and purely rational beings, stripped of individual personality. These specialists served impersonal systems. By downplaying an administrator's personality in the workplace, these new functionaries defied easy categorization as either masculine or feminine. Should administration be considered man's work? How about splitting wood or tempering steel? We know those jobs, and especially if you go into the mindset of the early 20th century, man's jobs. Or was it women's work, like mending clothing or washing pots and pans? In these early years of scientific management, administrators could either be masculine or feminine. You see, administration was androgynous. It was new and didn't nest in with any of the familiar conventions of what constituted men's work or women's work. And after all, it was that way by design. It was impersonal in its very nature. The Presbytery of Chicago's training school for Christian workers, which I had mentioned earlier, portrayed here again on the right, sought enrollees from the ranks of women. Its advertising assured prospective women applicants that efficiency experts in the church played a different role than that of pastors. Now, by the 1920s, women had already proven themselves as capable organizers in civic and church life. Women's organizations had, for generations by this time, promoted literacy and education. Temperance was a big issue. Poverty relief, women's suffrage. And those organizations formed networks, even national and international networks. They combined and shared resources and information and had grown sophisticated in their administrative structures. Women had long been administrators. Everybody knew that. But this was a different role than the pastoral role. And women's involvement in church administration, this advertisement on the right assures that women could apply and it wouldn't disturb traditional hierarchies that link spiritual leadership to masculinity. Excuse me. One advertisement explained, "The worthwhile efficiency expert doesn't try to run the business. He cooperates with its head and helps to carry out already agreed upon plans." And it went on to say, "Young women inclined to such service should write for information." The educational superintendent of the Presbyterian Board of Sabbath School Work, I love reading about these middle managers and I track their developments here, he made a similar clarification when he called for administrative expertise in Presbyterian Sunday schools. He proclaimed that the local church needs an educational engineer what we're seeing at Sunday school programs he's talking about. He said, one technically and ecclesiastically competent to take charge, control movements, and secure results. Yet such a position carried no spiritual authority, he said, noting that an engineer is not a boss, he's just a constructive expert. Because an administrator's presence in church organizations did not trouble gendered hierarchies linked to spirituality, women could fill these new roles just as men could. This consideration became a new factor in discussions about whether traditional ecclesiastical titles then could be conferred upon women. Now, I think back to printing, this will help illustrate the point. Like many forms of administration that Protestants introduced into church life in the 20th century, the operation of those duplicating machines was new, and it had no clear attachment to men's work or women's work. By this time, the typewriter had pretty much been gendered as a woman's tool. It was, again, if you think of pots and pans and sewing needles and sewing machines, you're going to think women. If you think welding torches, wrenches, you know, you think man's tools for man's job. The typewriter by this time had been gendered feminine. But the printer, the large printers, had been gendered masculine. But what about these new tabletop devices? Is it typewriter-ish or big printer-ish? You see, it defied easy categorization with pre-existing gender conventions about tools. And so what we have here, this is from an instructional manual, The Expert Typist, in 1922, that has a chapter on mimeograph operation. Again, this is scintillating reading. When you go into this stuff here, read The Expert Typist. But it's got instructions about step-by-step operations for the mimeograph. And notice that different steps, you can see that on the left, you've got a woman operating a mimeograph, and on the right, clearly it's a man. Their gendered identity is pretty clear with the clothing that they're wearing. You see the same thing in ads for multigraph. On the left, actually it's a stencil duplicator on the left, but you see a woman operating it, and then I'd already shown the same ad on the right, a man operating it. So, men's tools, women's tools. Well, let's come back to my central question. Why, in 1930, after a decade of debate, did Presbyterians approve the ordination of women as ruling elders? How did we account for this first? Why women's ordination in 1930? I argue that this decision to ordain Sarah E. Dixon had less to do with shifting views of women and the theology of women as it did shifting views of the office of what eldership meant. The understanding of the office shifted from spiritual authority to administration, and administration is something that women can do, so women can now be elders. This is why Presbyterians, for example, in this time, approved women as ruling elders, but not as pastors. In an earlier era, prior to the administrative transformation, the ruling eldership was, or had been, an office of spiritual authority. Ruling elders assisted ministers in the spiritual oversight and governance of the church, and the ministers, or the clergy, preached and administered the sacraments. The vote to admit women to ruling eldership indicated that the meaning of the ecclesiastical office had shifted away from spiritual leadership, which was associated with masculinity, and to administrative function, which was impersonal and therefore androgynous, could be masculine or feminine. This is precisely the analysis of Dr. A.J. Brown, who was the Presbyterian Missions Secretary. He says, I think we may observe a distinction between the ordination of women to the ministry and the ordination to the eldership. And he elaborates. He says this, ordination to the eldership is quite a different matter because eldership is largely an office of counsel and administration. I have had some opportunity to judge as to the value of women in counsel and administration. So why not? But he says it's different than the ministry. And he went on to describe women's organizational qualities, which has been understood since since the garden, I think, Adam certainly needed the infrastructure that Eve could supply to him. That wasn't new. But this privileging of administration in church life opened the way to the ordination of women. Now, what of this? Well, again, I opened with wondering why the ACCS folks wanted me to come and tell you about all this. This is just Schlecht being playful with his historical research and as a display of what I would suggest is historical creativity of interrogating sources and trying to read culture and the importance of things like habits and routines and their shaping influence on culture. We need to, as classical Christian educators, know how to read so much more than the big fat books, and we should be reading the big fat books. In fact, historical studies like this, I think, can help to inculcate the sort of skills to navigate what our students are going to encounter with the Twitter feeds and Facebook is getting old, and that's, can students drive down the road and read the landscape around them and understand its shaping influence. And it's really interesting to me, if we want students to be culture shapers and creators, and we do want that for our students, culture shapers and creators, in our historical reflection, do we tell them that the only thing that matters are the big fat books and the big fat minds that write them, and you can ignore everything else? Imagine this. I mean, this is the most ridiculous assertion. I teach church history a lot. Martin Luther thought justification by faith. Came up with that idea, recognized it as a Pauline idea. They're inspired by God in the scriptures. Justification by faith alone. And that changed Europe. Think about that as a historical claim. Is the idea that was floating around Luther's brain sufficient to explain a cultural transformation? Are we missing some steps? How do you get from Luther's head to a changed Europe? I mean, someone probably came up with justification by faith alone, every generation between Paul and Luther, they read the Bible. Why was Luther such a big deal? If it was all about the ideas, then all these other people, I haven't heard of them. I don't know who they are, but I suspect that they were out there. But we haven't heard about them because there are other things going on in history, you see, than thinking. Other things going on than thinking, and we need to think about that. We need to think about that. Are we teaching history skills and habits of reflection? Are we teaching culture to our students? And I'm just giving one sample, a detailed study of the interwar period. But I would hope that this would become an invitation into some bigger questions about how to think, about how to look at the world, about how to look at the world around us. I think that there's some particular reasons why this is interesting. And this is my stuff. This is my research. I hope that you have your stuff. The point is not that you need to join me in the study of early 20th century church administration. That's not the point. That's my stuff. Come up with your own stuff. What is your stuff? And even better yet, think in a certain way. So, boy, I hope when our children, our students grow up, they're coming up with their stuff and they've got insights and they see how culture has changed and shaped. And they might start to imagine how they can change and shape culture and start engaging things that